Today, this Sabbath, is a very interesting and very special Sabbath because he lays there now in the tomb. He sleeps. In the original Passover week, which we're all very familiar with, Jesus and the disciples took the new symbols of the Passover just exactly as we did Thursday evening. However, that week, 1900 years ago, we believe it was a Wednesday evening. But indeed, there was still a Sabbath after that Passover. And this week is very, though not exact, very applicable. Jesus would be in the tomb, just as Jonah was in the whale, for 3 days and 3 nights, and it was a prophecy. And so, this being Sabbath, and just a little after three, in just a few hours, 1900 years ago during that week, according to the prophecy, Jesus would rise from the dead. He would be called the firstborn from the dead, the firstborn among many brethren, as it says in 1 Corinthians. And it tells us that. Very special. Special of special, unique of unique. He was the first to be resurrected from the dead. This Sabbath, at this time, pictures an incredible series of events. And in just a few hours, everything would change. Everything would change forever. Dozens of prophecies over centuries of time, centuries of speculation by hundreds and hundreds or thousands of people, and the expectation and the discussion that they had, it would all culminate, all be fulfilled in just a few hours on a Sabbath afternoon, early evening. In researching this topic, I knew what Mr. Budge was going to be speaking on. I asked him, and he said, it's wax. I'm going to talk on wax. No, I'm kidding. He told me he was going to speak on unleavened bread. And so, as usual, he did a first-class job, and indeed, this is the beginning of the days of unleavened bread. But I knew that would be covered. And so I prayed a bit that he would lead me, not Mr. Budge, but God. And I asked some people, what would they like to hear? Not that they need itching ears and we're going to placate to what people want, but I was curious. And so I've decided on another aspect of this day, that this particular day has to do with the calendar, which I've studied greatly, but it may not be what you think. It may not be the aspect you think, because today what I'd like to discuss with you is a single period of time, less than 24 hours, possibly 10 to 18 hours, that changed everything for the world and for eternity. I don't want to get into the technical details because that's not what I want to focus on. I want to focus on the overview. I want to focus on a story, an understanding. Because this is a well-versed group. Many of you, as we heard in the first message, are second and third generation. Maybe anybody fourth generation? Fourth? Anyone? We're not there yet. We'll get there. I didn't see anyone. How many are first generation? There's a few of us left. But we want more second and more third and more fourth. So this is a well-versed group. You folks know your Bible. If you do have any questions, and they're highly technical and highly involved, Mr. Helge and Mr. Budge will be glad to answer those technical questions. But I want you to listen to the overview. And in fact, one of the traditions that we have in the Church of God is that we do read from the book of John. We read a lot. And I do not want to leave Jesus Christ in the tomb. I would like you to go back with me to Wednesday of that week, Thursday night for us. But let's go back to Wednesday of his week. Turn with me, if you would, to John 18. I don't know if you ever noticed in the Passover sequence of events, and all I've been in. Let's see, how many organizations I've been in? 1, 2, 3, 4. No, I've only been in a couple. And the minister's handbook, we call it, are identical. We read from John. We read a lot from John. But this we don't read. And this is John 18. Passover has concluded. Jesus has been betrayed by Judas at this point for 30 pieces of silver. Later, Judas would kill himself, so remorseful for what he had done. Jesus is arrested. We pick up the story in verse 28. Then they led Jesus from Caiaphas to the praetorium, and it was early morning. But they themselves did not go into the praetorium, lest they should be defiled, but they might eat the Passover. And we're talking about the Jewish authorities of the time. Pilate then went out to them and said, "What accusation do you bring against this man?" They answered and said to him, "If he were not an evildoer, we would not have delivered him to you." In other words, what do you think he's here for? A commendation medal? No, something wrong. Something is wrong. In fact, you'll remember he'd already been beaten. He'd already been slapped and beaten by the religious authorities at the time. Now, the praetorium, Pilate's residence, was a magnificent building. So as we read through this, just as you did Passover night, as we read through John 13, 14, 15, and 16, and part of 17, I know you followed along. They were not just words on a page, but they conjured up images. And we want these images as we read chapter 18 as well. So here's Jesus. He is standing there. He's already been, as we said, a little beat up by the religious leaders. He's been humiliated by them. They want him to look humiliated, and so Pilate sees him this way. Now, John writes very interestingly. John goes painstakingly through this evening. It's one of the main reasons that we use it during Passover, because it is so detailed. And so one of the interesting things there is John isn't here in this section. He wasn't part of the Roman authority. He wasn't part of the religious authority for the Jews. But obviously, God gave this information to John. And that's what makes the book so interesting. John identifies himself, when you read the book of John, never, ever by name. Not really. He uses a phrase. He calls himself the disciple, the other disciple. Though it was written late in the first century, that's the way he addresses himself. Not as apostle, simply disciple. And so you'll see that as you read the book of John. What's interesting about the Roman and the Jewish authorities is that it was really an unholy alliance between the religious leaders and Rome. E.O. White, in his book Meditations on the Passion, says Herod's family had once ruled, for while Herodians supported Rome and everything Greek or Roman, excusing Herod's infamous immoralities, the Pharisees opposed all foreign influence and maintained a most rigorous Puritanism. Yet they find, the Romans and the Herodians, they find common cause in putting Christ to death. That was something they both wanted to do. And so they were very uncommon bedfellows. So we continue. Verse 31, Pilate said to them, "You take him and judge him according to your law." Therefore the Jews said to him, "It is not lawful for us to put anyone to death." In other words, it's your job. That the saying of Jesus might be fulfilled, which he spoke, signifying by what death he would die. And that's a fascinating prophecy that he would die by a Roman process. Then Pilate entered the praetorium again, called Jesus and said to him, "Are you king of the Jews?" And we can see very, very, very rarely does Jesus speak. In the verses that we're going to read, and we're going to spend all of our time in John. We won't go anywhere else. He speaks very little, but what he speaks is very important. Jesus answered in verse 34, said, "Are you speaking for yourself about this, or did others tell you this concerning me?" Very, very incisive question. "Is this of your own?" Pilate answered and said, "Am I a Jew? Your own nation and the chief priests have delivered you to me. What have you done?" Jesus answered, "My kingdom is not of this world. If my kingdom were of this world, my servants would fight so that I should not be delivered to the Jews. But now my kingdom is not from here." Pilate therefore said to him, "Are you a king then?" Jesus answered, "You say rightly that I am a king. For this cause I was born, and for this cause I have come into the world, that I should bear witness to the truth. Everyone who is of the truth hears my voice." Had that brought up in the first message. Truth is critical. Truth is important. And he says, "Everyone who is of the truth hears my voice." Pilate said to him, "Quo es veritas?" So what is truth? Very famous line. What is truth? And when he had said this, he went out again to the Jews and said to them, I find no fault in him. And you will hear this over and over again. Three times, I find no fault in him. What has he done? And this is important because it was the custom at the time to release someone. And you can see, and you know the story so well, that Pilate may have some compassion for him, may have some feeling for him. This guy didn't deserve to die. He doesn't deserve to have him put through this. And so in verse 39, we pick up the story. It says, "The custom," he says, "but you have a custom that I should release someone to you at the Passover." And it was the Passover season. "Do you therefore want me to release to you the King of the Jews?" Then they all cried again, saying, "No, not this man, but Barabbas." Now Barabbas was a robber. And we can find out from parallel accounts in the Gospels of Matthew and of Luke that Barabbas was a very bad guy. He was not only a thief, he was an insurrectionist, a murderer. He was a very bad guy. What's interesting, I think, is what Barabbas means. It's Barabbas. We know what this means because Jesus uses the word when he prays Abba to the Father. Abba means father. Bar means son of. Barabbas literally means son of the Father. And this is the person they want to have released. Not the Son of God, but this man named Barabbas. The irony is incredible. Just absolutely incredible. And so we continue into chapter 19, verse 1. "So then Pilate took Jesus and scourged him." Again, he's beaten. "And the soldiers twisted a crown of thorns and put it on his head, and they put on him a purple robe. And they said, 'Hail, King of the Jews!' And they struck him with their hands." And just picture it. He's getting beat up for a second time, but this time with a scourge. They struck him with their hands. Verse 4, "Pilate went out again and said to them, 'Behold, I am bringing him out to you, that you may know that I find no fault in him.'" The second time he says this, "I find no fault in him." Some of the commentaries have a very interesting point on this, and they say that Pilate's attempt to present Jesus as this pitifully punished man, because to be scourged meant to have your skin whipped and flogged with either metal or wood. He had become fairly disfigured by now, by most accounts. Why did Pilate present him this way? This is the person you want to crucify? He's done nothing. I find no fault in him. So did Pilate put him in that condition to say, he suffered enough. Let him go. Let him go. They said, "I find no fault in them." Jesus came out wearing the crown of thorns and the purple robe, and Pilate said to them, "Behold the man. Behold the man." Therefore, when the chief priests and officers saw him, Jesus, they cried out, saying, "Crucify him, crucify him." Pilate said to them, "You take him and crucify him, for I find no fault in him." The third time. You'll notice in the book of John, there's this repetition of threes. We did not read it, but how many times did Peter deny Christ? Three times. And you'll see this repetition over and over again. It is for emphasis. It brings home the point. God's inspiring the book of John to bring that point across. This intensity. I find no fault in him. The Jews said to him, "We have a law, and according to the law, he ought to die because he has made himself the Son of God." It's blasphemy. The book of Leviticus is usually quoted as the reason. He continues. He says, "Therefore, when Pilate heard that saying, he was the more afraid and went again into the praetorium and again and said to Jesus, 'Where are you from? Where are you from?'" In other words, who are you? How has this occurred? Why has this happened? Why do they hate you so much? How could this be? But Jesus gave him no answer. So even though Pilate may have had some type, and we only can guess, of compassion, the people had none. They had absolutely none. In fact, what we see here is this last bit of dialogue this last bit of dialogue that Jesus will ever have back and forth with another human being. Pilate said to him, "Are you not speaking to me? Do you not know that I have power to crucify you and power to release you?" In other words, your life or your death is in my hands. My hands. Do you realize that? Jesus then answered, verse 11, "You could have no power at all against me unless it had been given you from above. Therefore, the one who delivered me to you has the greater sin." So what does Jesus do here? He basically absolves Pilate of any wrongdoing. "He has the greater sin that has delivered me to you." From then on, Pilate sought to release him. But the Jews cried out, saying, "If you let this man go, you are not Caesar's friend. Whoever makes himself a king speaks against Caesar." And so he puts Pilate right in the middle. When Pilate therefore heard that saying, he brought Jesus out and sat down on the judgment seat in a place that is called the pavement, but in Hebrew, Gabbatha. And they think archaeologically they have found that very spot. And so when we see him sit here, this means there is going to be a judgment. Now it was the preparation day for the Passover, and about the sixth hour, and he said to the Jews, "Behold your king." And we can at this point see this horribly, maybe disfigured individual. And he has bruises and welts all over him. "This is your king." And now everyone is in the mocking. But they cried out, "Away with him, away with him, crucify him." Pilate said to them, "Shall I crucify your king?" It's becoming repetitious, this back and forth seesaw. "Shall I crucify your king? We have no king but Caesar." Then he delivered him, Jesus, to them to be crucified. Then they took Jesus and led him away. This is a very sad situation. Jesus could have been let go. Have you ever watched a movie or read a book where the hero of the book, you don't know whether they're going to survive, but at every point, at every juncture, they could have gotten away. And another time they could have gotten away. A missed opportunity. But Jesus knows he is going, as it were, to the gallows. There would be no escaping it in any way. In verse 17, "And he, Jesus, bearing his cross, went out to a place called the place of a skull, which is called in Hebrew Golgotha, where they crucified him and two others with him on either side, and Jesus in the center." Now we know, again from other gospel accounts, they were thieves. It's fascinating that Jesus is surrounded by thieves. He could have been released, except there was a thief, Barabbas. They took the thief instead of Jesus, and now he's back again with two. It says, verse 19, "Now Pilate wrote a title and put it on the cross, and the writing was, 'Jesus of Nazareth, King of the Jews.'" This should have made the Jewish authorities absolutely crazy, right? Because he put it on the cross. Usually we think it's up high, and we have no idea. I don't want to get into whether it was, you know, this short a cross or it was staros, on. But I think that it was put up high so no one could get at it. "And then many of the Jews read this title, and indeed, for the place where Jesus was crucified was near the city. And it was written in Hebrew, Greek, and Latin." It wasn't bad enough it was written in Hebrew. It was written in Greek and Latin for everyone to see. "Therefore the chief priests of the Jews said to Pilate, 'Do not write King of the Jews.' But he said, 'I am King of the Jews.' Pilate answered." Now Pilate says, "What I have written, I have written." In other words, it's not coming down. It's staying up there, just exactly as I've written it. "Then the soldiers, when they had crucified Jesus, took his garments and made four parts, to each a soldier apart, and also the tunic. Now the tunic was without seam, woven from the top in one piece. They said therefore among themselves, 'Let us not tear it, but cast lots for it, whose it shall be, that the scriptures might be fulfilled, which says, they have divided my garments among them, and for my clothing they cast lots.'" And that's Psalm chapter 22. "Therefore the soldiers did these things." It's a horrible scene. A horrible scene. He's been stripped of his clothes. They're raffling them off, probably right there within the vicinity. And he's being crucified. What's interesting also is we have these visions in our mind. We really don't know what went on, but we can imagine. And yes, we've read the many chapters and the verses in the Gospels. We should, especially this time of year. We read some of them earlier this week. And the movies and the books, they're all out this year. There's new ones. They create these same images. And to some degree, those of us that know the truth, or hope we know the truth, should understand the truth. But at the end of the day, crucifixion is crucifixion. It is a horrible and agonizing death. What is sad is this person was not deserving of death. It was God's son. And yet, he was born to die. He knew the prophecies more than anyone else. The irony is fascinating. The irony is sad. Was there no other way? Was there any other way to get this done? Those of us that have children would never, ever willingly suggest that they die for anyone else, for another. Brethren, I'm not worth it. And neither are you. Would any of us have our children die for someone else? Let alone someone we knew, let alone a stranger. I think the answer would be no. There was no other way. A perfect sacrifice was required as well. Unblemished, walking according to the law, perfect, without sin. Which again, leaves all of us out. Though we may keep God's law, we do it very, very imperfectly. We surely do not keep it as Christ did. But then we look at the methodology. Was there no other way? If he had to die, he could have died many, many different ways. They could have just drowned him or hung him. But they chose this. It could have been made easier. It was not. It was not. It seemed they took at the time the absolute worst way to die. We continue the story. We left off in verse 24. We begin now verse 25 with a very, very touching scene, tender words, the last few words that Jesus were to ever speak. This is not a dialogue. This is not a back and forth, give and take dialogue. This is a series of statements and an implied request. Verse 25, now there stood by the cross of Jesus his mother's sister Mary, the wife of Clopas, and Mary Magdalene. When Jesus therefore saw his mother and the disciples whom Jesus loved standing by, and the disciple, guess who that is, whom Jesus loved standing by, he said to his mother, now notice what, I want to take you back to what Pilate had said. If you know your Latin, it's ecce homo. Behold the man. Notice what he says now. He says to his mother, verse 26, woman, or madam, behold your son. He then said to the disciple, behold your mother. And from that hour, that disciple took her to his own home. It's a very sad scene, very touching. Three beholds. Behold the man. Behold your son. And behold your mother. And indeed, John did care for Mary. And here are indeed the last, very last words that we read. In verse 28 of John 19. After this, Jesus, knowing that all things were now accomplished, that the scripture might be accomplished, said, I thirst. Now a vessel full of sour wine was sitting there, and they filled a sponge with sour wine, put it on hyssop, and put it to his mouth. So then Jesus had received the sour wine, he said, it is finished. And bowing his head, he gave up the spirit. This is a fascinating set of verses because a single word is used again three times. It is the word accomplished or fulfilled. The word, all things accomplished, scripture might be fulfilled, it is fulfilled or finished, is the word tetelestai. It means done. Means fully accomplished. Everything's been completed. He uses the word in its cognate in verse 28 twice and in verse 30. He ends when he says that it might be fulfilled, the prophecy in verse 28, I thirst. is Psalms 22 and 69. So up until his last breathing moment, he's fulfilling prophecy. Every prophecy was fulfilled. Many of them we don't even know. Many of them we guess at. They are known, obviously, as the messianic prophecies. Edersheim, in a couple of his books, estimates there's between 250 and 300 Old Testament references to the Messiah or the messianic age in one way, shape, or form. And so it says, I've accomplished it. It's the end. It's finished. I'm done. And it says, the very last sentence, and bowing his head, he gave up his spirit. So all the prophecies he had given his entire life to fulfill. In many ways, his death was an unnecessarily necessity. He died unnecessarily, but it was necessary. It was required. It was demanded, and no one else could do it. He dies. His life is over. At this point, he sleeps. He sleeps, as all men and women do. Most men and most women die for centuries. Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, Moses, David, all sleep. They all go to sleep. Many of our relatives and loved ones have gone to sleep. But in this story, there is more. Turn with me, if you would, to the book of Mark, chapter 16. I fib. We're going to do a little bit of Mark. We could have done it in John, but I think Mark brings out a couple more points. Mark 16, chapter 1. In verse 1, it says, Now when the Sabbath was passed, Mary Magdalene, Mary the mother of James, and Salome bought spices that they might come and anoint him. Very early in the morning, on the first day of the week, they came to the tomb when the sun had risen. And they had said among themselves, Who will roll away the stone from the door of the tomb for us? But when they looked up, they saw that the stone had been rolled away, for it was very large. And entering the tomb, they saw a young man clothed in a long white robe, sitting on the right side. And they were alarmed. I'll bet they were alarmed. But he said to them, Do not be alarmed. You seek Jesus of Nazareth, who was crucified. He is risen. He is not here. See the place where they laid him. But go tell his disciples and Peter that he is going before you into Galilee. There you will see him, just as he said to you. Turn back with me to John chapter 20. And so we see that Mary, don't be afraid. Mary, don't be afraid. He's not here. He has risen. He had already risen some many hours prior. Late on the Sabbath afternoon, or maybe early evening, just a few hours from now, 2,000 years ago, he rose. We pick up again in chapter 20, verse 11 of John. But Mary stood outside the tomb weeping, and as she wept, she stooped down and looked into the tomb, and she saw two angels in white sitting on the head and the other at the feet where the body of Jesus had lain. They said to them, Why are you weeping? She said to them, Because they have taken away my Lord, and I do not know where they have laid him. Now when she had said this, she turned around and saw Jesus standing there, but did not know that it was Jesus. Jesus said to her, Woman, why are you weeping? Seems everybody wants to know why this poor woman is weeping. We know why. They don't seem to know why. Why are you weeping? Whom are you seeking? And she supposed him to be the gardener, said to him, Sir, if you have carried him away, tell me where you have laid him, and I will take him away. Verse 16. Jesus said to her, Mary. She turned and said to him, Rabboni, which is to say, teacher. Jesus said to her, Do not cling to me, for I have not ascended to my Father, but go to my brethren and say to them, I am ascending to my Father and your Father, and to my God and your God. And Mary Magdalene came and told the disciples that she had seen the Lord and that he had spoken these things to her. There is so much here. A clock started when Jesus went into the tomb. 3 days, 3 nights. When Jesus came out of the tomb and rose to the Father, another clock started. He became the firstfruits of them that slept. He was the wave sheaf that had been spoken of in Leviticus. A single wave sheaf, ascending to the Father. Mary, don't touch me. Don't cling to me. I haven't yet ascended to the Father. He was the sacrifice that was to rise. And the count to Pentecost begins tomorrow. We will count 50 days. We talk about seeds planted in the ground and they bear fruit later. Just as Jesus' resurrection, so it pictures the resurrection of all saints later. So let's conclude. These 3 days that we observe, some not holy days, some are, like today. The Passover, the night to be much observed. Today, the first day of unleavened bread. And technically tomorrow we don't observe it, but it is the count to Pentecost. It is the first day of 50. It reminds us not only of Israel being watched over by God, Israel being watched over by God out of this immense love that God has for Israel. We celebrate that night. Hopefully you read of it or thought of it. If you haven't, you should. God watching over Israel. It reminds us today of the last few days of Christ. It reminds us that this is the beginning of the Holy Day season. It starts right now, today. The whole year on the Holy Day calendar starts at this time of year. It reminds us that though Jesus was God, he suffered horribly and died a physical death as that perfect sacrifice. He was betrayed, he was deserted, and he suffered. As we heard during Passover that evening, he knows our world. He was made human as we are, flesh and blood as we are. But he has overcome death and risen to be with God, as he promises he will allow us to do when he returns. And so it will be complete. And he does this again. He does this again because of the immense love he has for us. When we keep these days and honor these days, not other days that God did not prescribe, but these holy days, we align ourselves with truth, with the knowledge. This is the truth that we read about. When we read the book of John, we of all people, not that others cannot, we of all people should understand the truth in what we read and the deep spiritual meaning. I mean, the day of Passover, the first day of unleavened bread, and the day the wave sheaf offering is offered, pictures the holy day plan. And it has great deep symbolism. And it's important for us. As we fellowship today after services, 2,000 years ago approximately, Christ walked out of his tomb. He does not sleep. He is risen. So let us encourage one another this week and all weeks until we meet again with these thoughts.